Okay, so yesterday we talked a little bit about some ways of disciplining and how you get at disciplining and why you might choose the method you do by the kind of person you are and the upbringing you probably had and how you view power. And I promised you that today we would talk about some more ways of avoiding. I gave you some clues yesterday of avoiding discipline situations by limiting the number of rules and being sure that the rules aren't out of line with the child's developmental capabilities. It's crazy to have a rule that you can't touch anything on the coffee table when you've got somebody 18 months old, because he isn't capable of understanding that, and what you do is put up a power struggle. So today I promised you that we would talk about fielding children's negative feelings, because negative feelings always precede negative acts. And if you know that, it really is a very clever thing to do, to be able to dissipate the negative feelings before they disrupt into negative acts. In other words, if you don't want your kids to be hitting each other, then you've got to say to yourself, why do they feel like hitting each other? You know, why have they gotten into this pattern where they are, you know, using fists, or if they're girls, they probably will use words rather than fists. And if you disapprove of this, they will probably use words. But somehow or other, they are going to get out those negative feelings. How many of you are familiar with the pecking order in a chicken yard or with birds? Okay, do you want to tell us how that works in a chicken yard?
If there's one particular chicken, they all attack it until the chicken finally dies.
Mm-hmm. And how about the top chicken?
Well, maybe I was a little young to remember
that. We had some chickens that we got when the children were little as Easter gifts at some... Do you want to come over and sit over here? Yeah, there is some space there. When the kids were little, there was a department store that gave out baby chickens if you came in with an adult on Holy Week. I think it was a terrible thing to do, and I probably shouldn't have taken the children to get them, but they were going to go to some home, and maybe I felt I was saving the chicken by bringing it to a loving home. But it was interesting because, as it turned out, the chicken that lived at our house was a rooster. And he really was a feisty one. He would attack my legs as I walked from the kitchen to the back of the yard with the garbage to put in the garbage can. And the day that I decided he had to go was the day that my 3-year-old, who is now here as a 22-year-old, was leaning over I suppose some stones or bugs or something he was examining, and this chicken got up on his back and started pecking at him. So I quickly put an orange crate over the chicken and phoned Herb down at his office at the church and said, you know, you must find some place for this chicken to go right now, because he's not going to be happy under that orange crate for very long. But I'm really afraid to have him loose anymore because he's going to pick on the baby. So he phoned a man in the congregation who had some chickens and discovered that this man was very eager to have a rooster, because he had something like 8 or 9 hens, and he had no rooster, and he wanted to have a rooster to fertilize the eggs. So the man said, yes, you know, bring the rooster right out. Well, the funny thing was that when he got to the chicken yard, all of these hens attacked him. So, you know, there was no way that he was going to father any children for them, because they wouldn't let, you know, they picked him right away. And so the farmer, the man, he wasn't a farmer, he lived in the middle of the city, as a matter of fact, he penned the rooster up with the chickens one at a time, so that the rooster then could cow each chicken one at a time. And then when that chicken had learned who was boss, then he would put in another chicken, another hen. And finally, all the hens knew that the rooster was the dominant chicken in the chicken yard, and then the rooster could be let out to handle all 9 of them at once. So what happens in a chicken yard or among a flock of birds is that there is one bird that is dominant, and this bird then can pick on all of the birds. Well, then all of the birds then have a hierarchy, so that some of them, let's say out of the 9 hens, 8 of them were picking, or they were all picking on one. And, well, it works its way down so that the top bird gets picked on everybody, and then the birds immediately under that can pick on a few more. And it finally works down so that there are just a few birds picking. They all pick on the bottom one, you see, but nobody can pick on the top one.
this is apparently true of all animals. When I watch birds on my bird feeders, I see them doing this, and I've noticed this among my cats. I've got three cats, and the mother of the two boys really lets them know who's boss. I mean, every once in a while, for absolutely no reason at all, she just goes, and boy, they step back. Usually they can share and take turns eating when I feed them, but once in a while, she will really let them know. Now, even though we are the most sophisticated animal around, we still do this. Power is a great need for human beings, and we need to feel that we have power over our own lives. We all want to have control over our own lives and over our own environment. Have you ever had some sinking feeling when something happened and you felt like, I'm out of control, I can't, you know, all these things are impinging on me and I can't do what I want to do anymore? Everyone has that need. That's one of the basic needs of self-esteem, that we have some kind of control. So if you are a child and you have a parent, or you're an adult that has a boss who totally manipulates you, all you want, and maybe you have worked with people like this, all you want to do is get some piece of that power pie. You want to find a way that you can get some control. And children do this very hard. Well, maybe they can't get back at the parent, although they really try. They'll, if you won't let them do one thing, they'll think of something else that they can do. I mean, you can't win in that power struggle game. The kid can always get you. And, you know, it may take a little time, but he'll find some other way to get your goat. And what it teaches children is, you know, power is the priority thing to have, and you subject other things in order to have some power yourself. Then what the child generally does is to go out and find someone else who is less more manipulable than he is, and he will push his brother or sister or another child on the playground. A child who's a bully in a classroom is generally a child who's receiving a great deal of manipulation from someone bigger than himself, whether it's a sibling or a parent, or maybe all three. You know, he has this great need now to push somebody else. It works its way down to the bottom person. And you've probably seen kids in a classroom that just, you know, everybody can pick on them. They're the ones that everybody makes fun of. A mother asked me one time in a parenting session, well, I have a child who's being pushed into mud puddles on the way home from school. They're, you know, bigger kids bully my child all the time. She said, I really don't think that I should, you know, meet him halfway and protect him from this. He's got to learn to stand up for his own rights. You know, should I tell him to fight back? Well, if you're, you know, really into Christian pacifism, like Joe just described, by philosophy and by religion, you may feel that when Christ says turn the other cheek, that should apply to your kid on the schoolyard as well. And yet I think a lot of people who say, you know, I'm a Christian, do say to their child, if he hits you, hit back. Well, what happens when somebody hits back? That just means that the first person that hit has to hit again until finally they establish who is the dominant person. And again, if we're going to talk about the kingdom of God, is there a dominant person or is it a level kind of thing? So, you know, what I recommended to her was that she try to build this child's self-esteem so that he didn't let those children, so those children didn't see him as the bottom kid in the class on the pecking order, so that his self-esteem was such that he didn't have to be the one that was picked on. You see, they're going to find somebody. Kids who have that need are going to find the bottom person in the pecking order. So, you know, if your child is down there, you better ask yourself, why is my child's self-esteem at such a point that he lets these kids manipulate him? If, you know, you can't be manipulated. Nobody can make you do anything. You have to allow it. You can't, if you don't fight back, there can't be a fight. It takes two people to make a fight. Okay, that isn't about negative feelings, so we sort of got off the track there. So let's start now with how children feel, because we very often have children reacting to something that we do with negative feelings or coming home to us with negative feelings. And how do we then handle these feelings as they come? And I must say, these things I'm going to tell you are not only good with children, they're also good with friends, with spouses, with shop clerks, you know, anybody you meet. Let's try a little exercise now. Supposing that I come in and I'm really very, very hurt because I discovered that everybody in my class has been invited to a birthday party, and I'm the only kid that didn't get an invitation, and I saw them passing out these white cards, little white envelopes, and I'm convinced that I'm the only one that's left out, and I really feel hurt, and I feel jealous, and I feel bitter, and I'm very angry and upset about this whole thing. Okay, does anybody want to say what you would say to me? Now I'm your little girl and I'm coming home. I really feel rotten about this whole thing. Somebody want to? Let's go around. What would you say to me, Danny?
I think I'd probably try to do this with self-esteem.
By telling me I'm a nice little girl?
By telling me that. Yeah, probably. Just maybe take you somewhere.
To make up for.
Well, yeah. To make you feel like, hey, somebody cares.
Okay. What would you do, Sandy?
I've done that, because I've just told them sometimes moms don't let more than 20 kids go to a party and they have to pick one. Cannot go.
Okay. What would you do?
I think I would probably try to somehow build up the esteem, treating her a little bit special, or pointing out some good things, just to kind of take her mind off being negative.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you're going to take her mind off of how it is then. You're going to distract her with something else. Okay.
We have to talk about it. I guess I try to get a little bit at the human level of where she's at. Obviously, she's hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Okay, Bart?
I think I probably did the same thing, get her to talk about it. I can remember that so well.
The kid that was left out. Mm-hmm.
So I remember my mom and me talked about it.
Mm-hmm. Laura?
I think it's more helpful to echo the child's feelings and try to bring them out rather than push them down.
Mm-hmm. Okay, these are some ways that people handle them. Very often when we have negative feelings, people handle them with reasoning with us, you know, whether this is a good feeling to have or not a good feeling to have, or they use logic with it, or judgment, or advice. I told you yesterday about my youngest child when he broke up with the first girlfriend and how devastated he was. And one of the things that he found very unhelpful was the advice that friends gave him, like to find another really good-looking girl and take her to a party that you know that Sue is going to be at and make her jealous. Well, you know, this was advice he was getting, but it didn't help dissipate his feelings. Or something like reassurance, oh, well, you'll be invited the next time, honey. Don't worry about it. Or denial, well, you know, you don't really feel bad about this because, you know, who wants to be her friend anyway? Well, you know, the kid really does feel left out. And when you use a negative response to a negative feeling, like reasoning, logic, judgment, advice, reassurance, or denial, what it teaches the child is don't have negative feelings because they're bad, you see. And then what happens is the child must find some other way to act out these negative feelings. And this is where the feelings get acted out by, you know, hitting somebody else or sassing somebody else or, we'll go into the whole list of physical things that they could do as well. So the fastest way to dissipate the negative feelings is to accept them when the child comes in feeling hurt. Gee, you really feel left out, don't you, because you didn't get to go to that party. And you don't have to say, I understand, because, boy, there's nothing that makes you madder sometimes if you really feel bad for somebody to say, oh, I know how you feel, because you think they can't possibly know how I feel. They haven't experienced this. But just to accept the fact that you really feel bad. I can see that you're hurt or that you're angry or jealous or frustrated or whatever the feeling happens to be. When we don't accept the feelings, I remember a psychology professor that I had when I was working for my master's degree at Columbia saying that he had been in an apartment house one time when a child fell from a fifth-story window into an area well, and the mother slammed out the door and went down the stairs, and when she got to the bottom, gathered this hysterical child into her arms and said, don't cry. Well, you know, total denial of the child's feelings. Don't cry. Well, why wouldn't you cry when you had fallen out a fifth-story window? You know, what a frightening experience, to say nothing of the fact that there was probably all sorts of physical pain going on. But, you know, isn't this your first response? And this is what Chris was saying with his friend. What we're saying to him, in essence, don't cry. In other words, deny that you have these feelings. Don't let them out at all. And he finally withdrew from his friends because he said, it doesn't help. They don't know how to deal with my tears. And he was smart enough to realize that the tears were very therapeutic at that point, and he needed to cry until he was cried out, and then he needed to decide what to do. But at that point, he honestly wasn't for doing anything. He really was, you know, too distraught to do anything. And the tears were cathartic. So for a mother to say, you know, don't cry, builds a second set of negative feelings. And if you wonder why when you react these ways or when people react to you, you get even stronger feelings, it's because then you have a second thing to deal with. It makes you angry when someone denies your feelings. So then you've got two things that you're working on, the original thing that made negative feelings and now a new thing. So it keeps them going. So the quickest way to dissipate negative feelings is to accept them. If you really feel angry and you have a good friend or a spouse who's just, you know, calmly accepts the fact that you're angry and is sort of just gentle with you until you get over it, they'll go away much quicker than if you see that this person is just bristling or is tired of you being angry, or especially if they say something to you and want to, you know, you really shouldn't be mad about that because after all, that person blah, 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 and makes you feel like there's something wrong with the fact that you are feeling bad. We need to realize that feelings are not right or wrong and not put a judgment on them. The feeling is there. It exists. So, you know, putting a value judgment on the feeling being a good feeling or a bad feeling is not helpful to the person feeling that at the time. And that's not the time to talk about it. In fact, feelings are not good or bad. They exist. They are a reality to us. And when we put a value judgment on children's feelings that negative feelings are bad, what we tend to do is turn off all feelings. Then the child feels, there's something wrong with me for feeling. Feelings are unacceptable. And I'm a bad person because I feel. And generally, that kind of person that you know really is clobbered all the time for negative feelings will begin to turn off the warm feelings as well. And so we begin to have people who can neither rejoice nor get angry. I think we all know people like that because I think we are just coming out of an era when feelings are unacceptable, even happy feelings. I remember the shock that I had the first time I went to France. I was a teenager, and the accepted mode in the society that I had just come out of was that you didn't show your positive feelings. If you loved someone, you could tell them about it, but you did that quite privately. You certainly didn't do it out on the street. And to go to Paris and see people, you know, walking around with their arms on each other and walking up to each other and kissing right out on the street, for heaven's sake, you know, that's something you do in the bedroom or, you know, at least in the privacy of your home. So I think that we're beginning to see that it is not helpful to us to keep our feelings under wraps. But, you know, how did we get into that bag? Well, we get into it because the behavior that these feelings precipitate is what is unacceptable. And we want to talk a little bit later about what to do about the behavior that comes from negative feelings. So that's where we get into feeling uncomfortable and want to limit children. Okay. The reason that negative feelings need to be acted upon is because they cause physical changes. Think of the last time you got scared, really scared of something, or even the last time you saw a scary movie or a thing on television. What kinds of physical feelings did you develop? Yeah, well, you got clammy hands. Okay, your sweat glands were activated. What's another one? You get tense. Your muscles tense, especially the large muscles tense. They are ready for fight or flight. It's a primitive response, which was certainly a useful one back in the days when people lived in caves and didn't have, couldn't shut the door on the bears like we can do. You know, what if you really were out in the trail and there was a bear there? You would need to have the ability to flee quickly or to fight that bear for your life. And that's probably why we came built with these. What's another one? Muscles tensing, sweat glands acting. Your heartbeat really speeds up, doesn't it? Because it's got to bring the adrenaline from your adrenal gland and the blood sugar from your liver all over your body, again, to ready you to fight or to flee from the situation that's giving you the fear or the anger. Can you think of anything else that happens to you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the stomach? Yeah. Your stomach just feels like it's in a knot, and it actually is because this blood supply is being pushed from the stomach to the large muscles. So again, so that you can run or you can fight. So, you know, even though we aren't living in a primitive world anymore, our bodies apparently don't know that. And we are still ready for fight or flight, even when it's just a television show. And all we need to do to get rid of it is turn a button, which, you know, really doesn't take a lot of blood sugar or any of these other, you know, a lot of large muscle movement. we're still ready for that. And so the fact, when you get a lot of adrenaline in your system, and I say to you, don't be mad, you know, can you push that back into your adrenal gland at will? No way, can you? See, it takes time for that to be picked up by the blood and carried to the brain system if it isn't used. So that, you know, when we say to somebody, don't be scared, don't be mad, it makes them make a choice. Either they can lash out and use up those the readiness that their body now has, or they have to pretend like it isn't there. Now, you know, I don't know how much you feel it's good for your child to learn to pretend to be something that he isn't, but it has been found to be rather unhealthy to pretend to be something that you're not, and to sublimate the feelings that really exist within you. It brings out all sorts of icky little psychosomatic things, like migraine headaches come from this sort of thing. I think the recent research on asthma shows that a lot of asthma is triggered, even though it's a physical ailment, it is triggered by this kind of pushing the feelings inside, so they have to come out in some physical ailment. Sleepwalking is triggered by bottled up feelings. Hyperactivity in children, nail biting, head banging, a whole host of psychosomatic physical ailments are caused by the inability of the person to bring the feelings out, so they're turned in on the self. There are only two ways to go with negative feelings. One is to lash out on the world, and the other one is to say, that's really bad, and push it inside. So, you know, if you're dealing with children that are either very, very, you know, out with the fists and the words and angry sort of thing, or are having some of these psychosomatic ailments, which doctors very often just treat as a physical ailment and don't try to get at the root at, for goodness sake, begin to ask, you know, why has this child the necessity in his life to feel negative all the time? You know, why is there so much of this? Now, it's very normal for all of us to have negative feelings. Somebody said in a session last week, it was Jenny Witt's session, we were talking about mentors and models in our lives. And this person said that she really admired a brother of hers. I don't know, is the person who said that in the room here? I really worried about that, because the reason she admired her brother was because he never, ever got mad. Now, I think that's very unusual to be able to go through life and not come across things that are frustrating to you. You know, because we are social animals and we relate to each other all the time, I mean, you know, my desires get in the way of your desires. And you know, supposing I came in here late, I want a seat. Well, those of you who came in late have to sit on the floor, even though you want a seat. You know, surely that's a frustration. And, you know, maybe you're a calm kind of person that doesn't get bothered by some little thing like that, but it's hard to believe that there aren't things in the world that make you angry. And if there aren't, maybe I guess I even feel sorry for you. I think we should be angry about injustice, for instance, the kinds of things that Joe was talking at the last session. That is, you know, that should generate some kind of negative feeling on our part, and even to the point where we want to do something about that. You know, what can we do about South Africa? And, you know, why are we so lucky and they're so unlucky? Why doesn't that make us angry enough to want to do something about it? Maybe that's not good, that we're bland and unfeeling.
I know what somebody was. I have a very strong, very fiery temper, and I certainly admire people that can be calm and very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like my sister's boyfriend never gets mad. My father ran into his Jeep and he didn't get mad. You know, he just...
Mm-hmm. But maybe down inside,
yeah,
he was hiding what he felt. Does he have an ulcer or...
No. He's a drummer.
He's a drummer. Okay. He's getting it out on that drum, Benny. All those negative feelings. Boy, you can beat that old skin there.
Very good drummer.
Maybe very... Well, I think that it's good to develop a looseness toward the world, that you don't have to get upset about a lot of things, because, after all, a lot of things are just plain unavoidable. Why bother getting mad at them? You know, and it certainly isn't healthy, for instance, to sit in your car and be angry at the other drivers. You know, there isn't one thing that you can do about those other drivers, and you are going to get yourself an ulcer or an early heart attack or something if you let things like that bother you. But do you? Okay, that's a good way to release those feelings, to talk to them. Chicago, you ought to try Italy if you think people are in there. The fists are out the window.
I have a grandson that is adult. The day he was difference between pattern recognition and behavior that we, mm-hmm. that evokes. And that if we as adults could just say, you know, for sitting behind them, man, I am furious, you know,
yeah,
admit it as having a feeling, but then, you know, also as a rationale, know that we're not going to go, you know, slam mm-hmm. the wall's car to you because that's the behavior that reacts to that.
Well, some of the research seems to show that if you have been taught to bottle up those feelings and have not been allowed expression of them, that they don't dissipate and they build up. And if you find yourself with a fiery temper, it may be that you've got, you know, 20 years of bottled up feelings that are there. It's like a volcano, you know, always waiting to erupt, and the smoke is always coming up and the fire is still in there because it never boils over.
And family. Get that out of other, you know, like I learned how to get it out of my sister. She mm-hmm. knows the right buttons to push with me to get
uh-huh.
the same thing.
Uh-huh.
I think a lot of families reinforce that behavior.
Oh, absolutely we do. That's exactly what we're talking about. Maybe I can explain it on a physical level better. One of my babies, in the process of being toilet trained, apparently thought that what I was saying by don't put this in your diaper was don't do it at all. And he began having stomach aches. And I really was really getting a little bit fed up with this whole thing, because after every meal I would get dirty training pants to change. And, you know, it wasn't just one good one that you could clean up and forget about it till tomorrow. It was, you know, all day long, these little messes to clean up. So he had to go to the doctor for something else, I think an ear or something, or more likely an injury. My kids weren't very sick, but they got lots of injuries. And I said to the doctor, you know, would you give his stomach a good exam while he's in here? Because he complains of stomach aches so often. And I had just said to him, do you have any new tricks on toilet training? I am getting fed up with the dirty training pants. I mean, not wet training pants, dirty training pants after every meal. Oh, he said, you know what's probably happening is he's just got intestinal cramps. He said, probably what's happening is that he feels he shouldn't eliminate. See, it's bad to do. So he's trying very hard not to go potty at all. And he said, eventually the colon gets so full that some of it just pushes out, but, you know, just a little bit. But it never gets a good emptying like it, you know, like it normally does. And so, you know, after every meal, you put something at the top, it pushes a little out at the bottom, and you get these icky panties that clean up. So, you know, feelings are the same way. You know, if you don't let the whole thing dissipate when it's there, when it builds up, then it's going to be still down in there, and, it's, you know, a little bit of steam will come out, like you say, when the right button gets pushed or somebody opens it up a little bit. You'll get a little bit because you're not allowed to deal with it fully. You'll put the lid back on as soon as you can get back into control. Okay. So, now you may feel like what I'm advocating is that everybody goes around losing their tempers or, you know, flaring out their jealousy and so on. And again, you know, bottling up the feelings and causing negative feelings or kids that are, you know, taking it out on people lower on the pecking order is one extreme. The other extreme, just like the power bit, is to let it all hang out. And every time you get mad, you just let fly at whoever is there. If you're jealous, you tell them about it. And if you're, you know, just tell everybody how you feel. Well, that probably isn't very helpful either. For one thing, a lot of people are going to get hurt. And for another thing, you're going to start feeling a little bit insecure about that whole thing. Because when a child has more power than he can handle, that is a very insecure thing. That's what is so scary about the laissez-faire parent who cops out on setting limits for a child, the opposite extreme from authoritarianism. That amount of power a child can't handle, and so it makes the child feel very, very insecure. So, okay, what do we do then to give children, you know, positive ways of handling negative feelings? Well, the first step, of course, is to not say your feelings are bad, don't have them, whether you're saying that in your actions or whether you're actually saying it in words. Accept the fact that the child is angry. Accept the fact that the child is jealous. If you've got more than one child, you're going to have jealousy. Just accept it. I heard a psychologist say one time, the only way to totally get rid of sibling rivalry is to drown all but one child. And, you know, if you really don't care for that solution, then you're going to have to find, you know, positive ways for letting this youngster deal with the jealousy that is probably inevitable. After all, there are two kids in a family, and the parents are going to treat them alike or treat them differently, and they may, you know, have some negative feelings about that occasionally, or even comparing themselves with each other. So, rather than controlling having emotions, what we want to work out is controlling the behavior. Now that's a really, really important distinction to make, especially when you're dealing with a child's self-esteem. And self-esteem is the basis for all of our behavior. And again, I think we can go back to scripture here. God gives us some clues for how our behavior should be, but he never says, you are bad, I don't love you because you can't keep the Ten Commandments, does he? He talks to the behavior. I wish, because I love you so much, that you did keep the Sabbath day holy. And I wish you would stop killing each other because, you know, I love all of you and it hurts me to see some of you getting killed by others and so on. This is the kind of language we find in the Bible. But we never ever read, you know, you are no good, therefore you're not going to be my child anymore. And we must be sure that children are getting that message from us. And very often the kinds of things we say and do with children preclude their getting that feeling. So you have to watch your child carefully and say, you know, is my love for him getting through? Or is it saying to him, you aren't any good? Well, one of the ways we can do that then is by giving I messages, I feel that. And this also gives him a model. Well, allows him then to be the disciple of the model who doesn't say, you are bad, but I don't care for that kind of behavior because. And then if the child is old enough, because gives him some clue as to, you know, how he can change and make you happy. The big hold we have on little kids, the under 8 set, is their desperate need for belonging. They will do anything to belong to you, to get your attention. And if the only way they can get your attention is to do something naughty and bizarre, they will learn that. I have seen 3-year-olds, 2-year-olds even, who have learned to do something the adult wasn't. We had a 3-year-old here last week that was doing some kind of scrappy things. And I really, you know, watching that family situation would guess, and I don't know well enough to say for sure, nor am I an expert enough to say for sure, but I would guess that that child is feeling neglected. And there's a real good reason for that right now. But you have to ask, you know, how is the child feeling? Not what am I doing, but how is it coming across to the kid? So, you know, the next step then is to be sure that the messages you are giving is, you know, this behavior hits me this way, but not, I don't like you because you're a naughty kid for being angry or something, but it really kills me to see my kids hitting each other. I wish I didn't have to watch that. Well, they may say, okay, we'll do it in the other room, Mom. And, you know, that may be a good solution, but at least they know how you feel about it. I think the biggest control she had over me was love. I wouldn't dare do something because I knew it would hurt her feelings. You know, that would just crush Mother if I did thus and so thing. And she never had to say, don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other thing. But I had, you know, this picture of what kind of a person, of a loving person, it was in response to her love for me that she controlled me without setting out to control. But you see, what that did was to let me decide how I was going to behave, rather than her deciding how I was going to behave. My behavior was in response to the love that I was getting, rather than to dictates that I was getting. And certainly then, when I got to the place where she wasn't around to dictate, I was used to making a decision on how I was going to behave. And like we said yesterday, the main goal of discipline is self-discipline. And you can't do that too young, because our times have changed and we have our children with us less and less of the time. You know, the brownie leader has got them, the teacher has got them, the neighbor has got them, the TV has got them. How much time do you really spend with that child? How much influence do you really have anymore? Okay, so another really neat way of handling feelings is to hear empathically. And we kind of touched on that a little bit before. When you really hear a person, you can be listening and not hearing. If the child is pouring out what happened at school today, and he did and she did and they said and so on, and you're thinking, let me see, I better get the beans on next because the meat is almost done. You know, the kid is going to get that right away. You really can't fool kids too easily with this. I mean, if your feelings aren't genuine, they get that real quick. I mean, like this big, they're already getting whether your feelings are genuine or not. I think it comes along through the umbilical cord maybe even. So you can't very well hide that. So hearing empathically is a skill to really, really try to develop. And like I said before, it's not only good with your kids, it's good with everybody you come in contact with, even the garbage man who's complaining because you don't put the garbage cans in the boulevard and leave them in the garage like the brokerings do. It means sensitive attention to what the child is saying, and really sensitive, so that you are actually understanding what this child's feelings are. And that not only comes through the words the child is saying, but through the body language. And if the child is quite young, he's not going to be able to verbalize his feelings. It'll come out totally in body language. Then the second step in hearing empathically is to reflect back the feelings that you are hearing. You really feel angry, am I right? I think you can run that into the ground. I have a friend who says continually, what I hear you saying is, and it's like a record he turns on until I feel like saying, you know, find another way of saying that. I'm tired of it. What I hear you saying is, but it was a skill he learned at some workshop somewhere, you see. And I mean, you can practice it with a phrase, but after you practice a little bit, try to find, you know, 6 or 8 ways of saying that, will you? But what you do is to reflect back the total message that this child has now given you with his body and with his words. And sometimes you have to be able to read between the lines, because what the child is really saying is not what he's actually saying, where the real feelings are. One of the things that we need to recognize is that anger is a secondary feeling. The anger is always because of jealousy or frustration or despair or, you know, some other negative feeling. So you have to look through the anger to the clue of to what really is causing this. And sometimes the thing that has triggered the anger is not the thing that the child is really upset about. There's some underlying thing. Because have you ever said to yourself, well, gosh, I wonder why I got so mad about that. That wasn't so important. Well, he probably wasn't really so mad about that. What he was so mad about was something far more basic. But this was the thing that was the button that got pushed, the final straw that broke the camel's back.
Isn't that a revelation of psychology in school, because we can tell them that you don't really mean that.
Okay. Yes, I had one that majored in psychology. You had that major in chemistry, or? Okay. Well, I'd like to suggest that you spend the rest of the day, or maybe even the week, practicing this skill by listening to people talk to each other. And listen how the people around us in the village now, or in your family, feel each other's feelings. See if you hear them denying the negative feelings or putting them down. I remember a time that I got angry here in the village. I was running a stitchery class up in the basement of Chalet 7, and one of these big officious preacher types came in just to look around. No, he would not join the class. He just wanted to look around, and his, you know, sort of superior attitude that said, well, you know, I wouldn't lower myself to taking a stitchery class, for heaven's sake, but I'll see what's here in the village. Well, there was a woman who really was feeling kind of defeated and very uncreative, but she was really trying to be creative. She really wanted to let loose. And she was designing a banner that she was going to do in yarn on a piece of burlap. And she had tried and tried to draw a dove to represent the Holy Spirit. She was making a baptism banner. And she very timidly, fearfully said to me, does this look like a dove? You know, she said this to me as the teacher of the class, and here is this visitor who won't join the class but is just walking through, and he says, no, it looks like a bomb coming down or some dumb thing like that. I mean, you know, she did have very negative feelings. She was trying to flip them over to positive feelings, really trying hard, because I'd given this big pep talk about how we're all creative inside of us, and, you know, what we need is to be freed from all this put down that we've had all through our school years by teachers telling us the way to do it. And she was trying so hard, and here came this clop from, you know, some outside source. Well, she really was not up to that. And what happened was she took that drawing in her hand and crunched it into a ball, and she did not finish her banner. Now, you know, what right had this man, especially a man with a cloth, to come in and give this woman this awful negative thing? You know, isn't our mission in this world to build each other up? You know, that this is what Christ does for us, and we must do it to each other, like the song said at Vespers last night. You know, you want to pass it on. Well, it works the other way, too. The more put-downs we have received, the more we need to pass them on. He walked out. I glared at his back. I was sick. I was so dumbfounded. I really didn't have some ready answer, and I was not assertive enough myself. That was some years ago. Now, I think I would have taken him on, really, and said, I really think that was unfair of you to walk in here, number one, disrupt this class, number two, to say this negative thing to this person who is struggling so hard to, you know, build up her own positive feelings. Yeah.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. In trying to think about this whole package you're talking about, I'm in a new place with my own child who's 8, and I hear just tons and tons and tons of negative from him, like within the last year.
Mm-hmm.
He's gone through some really heavy stuff emotionally, but which I know
that's where it's coming from.
With
sure.
Why he's feeling negative, but also in my own saying to him, if I confront him about bad behavior, and saying to him, you know, I don't like what you're doing because
mm-hmm.
well. You know, I like you, or whatever all those words are, which is what you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What he's done now is turn all that against himself, and I can't do anything right. See, that just proves it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm crummy and blah, 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 blah. And I hear this over and over and over. And the building up stuff can almost become as phony or as unwanted.
That's
as
right. That's why it's so important for you to, you know, to give the I message. I feel that behavior is stuff. But you've got to counter that also with lots of you know, positive input at other times. Like yesterday we talked about, you know, giving attention before the kid asks for it.
You know, just the other day I asked him, I said, you know, today I'd like to really try to hear the nice things that I've told you also,
mm-hmm.
you know, to help him zero in on the positives, because he's just so inwardly negative now, and it
mm-hmm.
really bothers me. But at the same time, it's almost like a conflict. Like, you know, my general feeling is, you know, I've told him, you know, I don't think you're a rotten kid, you think you're a rotten kid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I really generally feel that feeling that his own positive feeling has to come through me. I can't.
That's right.
I can't tell him. I can't tell him 500 words. I can't convince him.
You can't ever make him feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I feel extremely frustrated with, how do I convince you, or how do I, you know, how do I keep some positive stuff? How do I help you keep some of that, your own positive self esteem?
Mm-hmm.
And
is he getting it from lots of sources, that his the negative feelings toward himself, like from school and playmates?
Yeah,
and
I think he's getting it. But, you know, it's like he's choosing to, I mean, like I can see
mm-hmm.
him putting tons of energy into proving what
mm-hmm.
a lot of kid he is.
Mm-hmm.
And it just frustrates the heck out of
me. If you can't prove that you're good enough, you know, people will often take the opposite thing. Well, if I can't be good enough, I'll be bad enough. And once a child gets set into a certain belief about himself, then it's, you know, you can misinterpret, and it can start with babyhood. A baby who, you know, if you're under 2 years old, I really, really believe that your gut level needs for food and sleep and attention have got to be met immediately, because under two, you really aren't capable of deferring those needs. So if a child is put off, like, you know, an 18-month-old is made to wait for dinner because daddy isn't home or something like this, and daddy wants the family to eat together and so on, the child gets grouchy and irritable because of low blood sugar, but he also gets the feeling that, you know, I'm not really a very important person in this world, and I have to fight for my rights. And once he views himself in that misconception, you have a heck of a time talking him out of it, because then he continues to misinterpret. You know, deliberately, as you say, your child is doing, misinterpret all the things that happened. We as adults are still doing that. You know, what did she mean by that? Well, she probably meant I'm icky, you know, and actually she probably didn't mean anything. Or, you know, she might have even meant it, like you're saying, as a compliment. So you really do have a tough task on your hands,
yeah,
turning this kid around.
Like, I see that as a real script that didn't
bring it is.
I've been doing a lot of my own
talking
with my father's research that way, and I think that operates for me very much on a personal level.
So he's getting a model.
Yeah, and so mm-hmm. I'm starting to think, well, you know, how many models does he
have? Yeah,
uh-huh. But, and I really thought seriously about whether we might go together and do some therapy work with it to help, you know, our own decisions to change that model. Because the
iron... I would, because... Sure. But you're not dwelling on those. And you see what's happening with your youngster, he's already down to the third level down. The next level is that he just quits altogether. And then you really have a problem. I've got a book with me that I'd like to give you to, you know, read some of while you're here, because it speaks to that as through play therapy with a child. And you might get some good clues as a mother with that, too. You know.
I don't remember what it is, but I'll go up and get it after lunch and yeah, you have to send. Well, I don't know if you even get it in the library. I think you'd have to mail for it somewhere. But I'll go get it then right away. I honestly don't remember the first one. 8. Mm-hmm.
I have a 9-year-old.
It's into the same bag. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, listen, we better chuckle along here if we're going to get it all to what I told you about creative thinking. I wanted to help you with that. Okay, so one of the things that you've kind of led into that is very, very crucial for parents is watch your tone of voice. You know, really listen to what your tone of voice is. You can say the same thing and it comes off different. Like you can say, "You're angry, aren't you?" Now, what does that say? If you say, "You're angry, aren't you?" Do you see the difference? I mean, the words were the same. If you saw them in print, you could interpret it anyway. But the child is going to interpret it. I have a young friend who's really been struggling with changing her power. So she has a real problem with a power struggle with her 7-year-old. And when she's noticed that her 3-year-old was beginning to do it too, she really sat up and took notice, you know, what's going on here? So she read Dreiker's book of Children, the Challenge, and it talked about using logical consequences instead of punishing. And nothing changed at all. And what she's discovering is that she is using the logical consequence as a punishment, so it isn't working at all, you see. But it's her tone of voice. Well, you know, if you don't come in and eat your dinner when I call you, it won't be there. And, you know, the child is still reading this as mother is punishing me. Now, one of the things that is really crucial if you have a child that is maybe over 8, and, you know, all children, when I say 8, that's sort of a general time when children change over from early childhood, as Piaget calls them, pre-operational patterns, if any of you are familiar with his stuff, to a new level of thinking ability. So that's kind of a intermediate age there. And that's why it's pretty important that you do something before he gets any older there, too, he said in his pattern. Now, what was I going to say? I've lost my train of thought. I do that. That's why I have to make notes here. Well, okay, we already spoke about accepting feelings without a value judgment. Save your no-nos for the behavior. And yeah, and I was talking about my friend, wasn't I? Talking to that child. I still don't remember what it was. Maybe it'll come to me and I'll come back to it. One thing that I should say that, you know, sometimes you really feel like that the child has no reason to be jealous or has no reason to be angry or you know, any of these negative feelings. And when you accept the feeling, you should be sure that you realize that accepting the fact that the child is feeling this doesn't lay a judgment on it, that you aren't accepting, you aren't agreeing or disagreeing with the kid whether it's right or wrong for him to be feeling this at the time. You are just accepting the fact that he is feeling it. I think a lot of times people don't want to buy into this because they say, but, well, you know, he has no business being angry about that. But he does, and that's what he needs accepted. And again, our clue from Scripture, God accepts us as sinners. And so, you know, we've got to accept our children as sinners because they follow the model, as you were saying. Okay, so then another clue is once you have, you know, listened very carefully and reflect back and watch your tone of voice with the child, don't put any judgment on it. You need to provide then some acceptable outlets because if this energy, as we spoke before, is bottled up, it is going to come out in against society someplace beside you that is putting the stopper, or it's going to come out with psychosomatic ailments that you don't want this kid to have either. Have you known little kids with ulcers and migraines and stuff? I have, and it's kind of sad. So let's talk quickly about some ways of providing acceptable behavior. That is a way of dissipating this physical energy, this adrenaline, this blood sugar, this set for fight and flight. If I went around the circle and asked you what you did when you got angry, I did this one time, but the time is going, so we won't do it quickly here. One woman said she'd like to knead bread when she was angry. Well, you see what that's going to do. That uses the large muscles. It gets the blood going. The adrenaline gets taken out, and the physical set then dissipates. Somebody else said she liked to scrub floors. I remember a time when we bought a punching bag for our house as an anger dissipator. That's a good one. You know, you can't hit your little sister, but since you feel like hitting, like, you know, down and punch that leather because it doesn't care. At nursery school, we find that potter's clay is absolutely super. Man, you can poke it, you can pinch it, you can bite it even if you don't mind having it in your mouth. You can pound on it as hard as you want. It just smiles right back at you. In fact, it might turn into something neat. So that the physical energy that has built up gets dissipated. If you have a child that's older than 8, it's probably really wise to help them develop the skill of talking out their emotions, like some of you people have mentioned here. And then again, be sure that you use these empathic hearing skills, that you're really tuned in and you're reading the body language and saying to yourself, you know, what is ultimately responsible for this? What is the feeling beneath this anger? Sometimes, even with older children, we need to provide ways to act out feelings. And if you have a home that has, you know, no scissors for the child to cut or no art supplies or so on, you're limiting the child. Puppets are a good way. It's neat to watch kids playing with dolls or playing with puppets and acting out these things. You will very, very often hear yourself talking. I told you yesterday about the little girl that said, well, the rule is, and I thought, oh, that's the old teacher talking over there. I had a youngster come to kindergarten one time who was so distraught, and she so often came to school angry. And one of the reasons you don't want children to be boiling with this anger and keeping it undissipated all the time is it plugs up the learning roots. And you send a kid to school who can't learn because all the nerve endings and the blood vessels and the whole mental effort is clogged up with anger, and so there's no learning can get through. And that's what was happening to Valerie. She was mad, 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 and all of a sudden I realized, my word, we've been here a half an hour and I have only given the most superficial attention to the rest of this class. So, you know, Valerie is here, and you know, she was getting all my attention. So I said, Valerie, why don't you go over and paint me a picture of how you feel? Okay, she said, well, we had just mixed up some fresh paints, and the reds were bright red, and the yellows were very garish, glaring colors. And she was back in 5 minutes with this great, big, huge, wet, gloppy paint, and she said, here's a picture of you with your head in the toilet. I want you to know that she skipped off, and the rest of the morning went very smoothly for her, and I think she probably was able to learn. Now, I was not the person she was mad at. You see, I had done nothing to trigger this anger. She came to school angry, but she could take it out on me because I would take it. And so that's why she painted the picture. I was foolish enough to write that on it because I thought that was fantastic that she was able to do that. It was so cathartic, so therapeutic for her. And I also thought the parents ought to know that she felt this way. So I wrote that on the picture and let her take it home. Wrong thing to do, an experienced teacher. All it did was to get more of whatever made Valerie angry, she got more of at home. This was a bad, B-A-D, in capital letters, thing to do. You do not paint your teacher's head in the toilet. What a dirty, nasty little girl you are. Anyway, you know, that's the way she felt. And you know, it needed to be accepted. So painting is a super way. Puppets, if you have an older child, let them write. You know, put it down on paper how you feel. Write a story about some other people who feel this way. I told you that yesterday that I like Dorothy Briggs because I agree with her. There is one thing in her chapter here that I'm not sure I agree on, because I have heard some research that probably was done while she was writing the book or since she wrote the book. She recommends that you can give the child a pillow or a teddy bear or something and say, you can't hit your little brother, but you can pretend this is your little brother. There has been some recent research that says that is not helpful, that continues the anger toward the person. But you can say, because you are feeling angry and need to hit, you can hit this pillow. So there's an area I disagree with her. I haven't found anything else I disagree with her with. It's not usually, you know, they're not going to agree with everything an author says.
But how do you think about this? Things they're using in psychoanalysis now, the sponge rubber things that they use.
Yeah. No, I don't know, what are they doing?
People just hit each other with it.
Hit each other with them? I would disagree with that very much. Yeah, because I think, you know, it's like I have heard a child psychologist on the radio say that, you know, you should let children play with toy guns because the gun is just an extension of the fist. I think that's right, it is. And, you know, when are children going to learn that killing someone with a gun is socially unacceptable? You know, I mean, I think they can learn very little to say,
yes, I am angry, and to dissipate the anger some way. You may not be able to get rid of the cause of the anger. You know, the baby brother is not going to disappear. And, you know, very often, very little children become very frightened of these negative feelings because they wish the baby was dead. And then, you know, they get scared that maybe the baby will die. And then if the baby does die or get sick, they feel guilty and think, you know, I wish that it was dead, and it is. And boy, you know, I did that. And they get tremendous feelings of power, which they can't handle. So, you know, it's real important for you to help them to realize that everybody has these feelings and that there isn't a cause and effect thing. Little kids can't understand that, of course. But, you know, that there was a reason. It was germs that killed the baby. You didn't kill the baby. Or, you know, it was because it wasn't formed right when it came or something. You might never be able to get that across. There have been lots of novels and movies written on that. No, I think that there is some research that says that's bad, mm-hmm. to do that. But, you know, we always...
Having had a lot of experience using the concept and learning how to use them, and even if it comes physically, I feel really good about the training that they gave.
You do.
As to how to use them and what kinds of boundaries to set, and that they weren't just picking up, you know, beat up.
Okay, I don't really know enough about it to make a judgment. All I can go on is, you know, what I've read, that it is probably not helpful to say, you know, pretend this is your brother and hit it. But to say to the child, you know, you do have these feelings, and if you feel like punching, here's something you can punch, because you can't punch your little brother. You can't punch your little brother because he doesn't want to be punched. And he has some rights, too. You know, I mean, children have to learn as early as they can, which is probably somewhere beginning around 3 1/2, and they can't learn. It's not like, you know, a line, now you are 3 1/2, you're going to learn this, kid. But at 3 1/2, the average child is able to begin learning to take another person's point of view. Don't expect much of that before that, because they are developmentally incapable, just like they couldn't sit up when they were born, and you didn't expect them to. Well, don't expect them to be able to share when they're 2 just because they can talk. They can't. They can't understand it yet. And I think we get into a lot of trouble with our kids because we don't know what to expect of them at different age groups that way. Okay. When you pick an outlet for children, there are two things. It should not harm. I want to put hurt and harm together. It should be an outlet that doesn't hurt anybody else, doesn't get into anybody else's right, and that's why you can't hit the baby, because the baby has a right to sit in his crib without being hit. And the other thing is that it doesn't harm any property. It doesn't destroy property. But then you have to be sure that there are outlets at your house that the child can do. Whether, you know, if digging in the garden is a good thing for that child, then find a place he can dig, a sandbox or something indoors that he can use. Water is a super thing. Poke the wrong things. Okay, we have to limit the expression of feelings then to things that won't harm others and that won't hurt property. But there's some other things that we need to take into account with limiting them. Children should be taught that they can't just throw their negative feelings at anybody. The family that loves you is the place to tell about not getting the birthday party invitation, you know, or, you know, maybe your teacher is somebody that will listen to that. But you don't need to tell every kid in the class, you know, I really feel mad because Marianne didn't invite me to her party. There are appropriate people to discuss your feelings with. And, you know, be sure that you are an appropriate person that can listen empathically to the child. There are appropriate times, and even the appropriate people may not have time at the time you need to tell it. If mother is on her way to choir rehearsal, she will maybe have to say, you know, I really am interested in hearing about how you got slighted at school, but I'm going to be late if I listen now. As soon as I come back, I will, or, you know, tomorrow morning while you get dressed, I'll get up and make breakfast early. Be sure you don't let the kid down. Be sure that if you do that you do come back and hear about it, so the child learns, I can count on my parent. Because there's nothing worse than a parent you can't count on. Oh, you aren't going to listen anyway. You really don't care will be the thing they'll take. There are also appropriate acts for dissipating your anger. And the child can learn very, very young what kinds of acts are appropriate and which are inappropriate. And that harming property and other people's rights are inappropriate.
Okay, don't you think? Mm-hmm. I agree with that too, but
in that, I think the child has to realize that the parent has been let down a lot.
Yeah. Okay, and then when you let him down, what do you do? This is where they learn forgiveness, isn't it?
Then you talk about being having been let down, and that's part of life too.
That's right.
And
I don't let you down because I don't care, and I don't let you down intentionally.
I'm sorry.
Yes, there is the big word. That's a neat way to model for children, to say I'm sorry when you blow it. A lot of parents feel they can't do that. And that's unfortunate because, you know, if you say you're sorry, doesn't that elicit a softening from the person who hears that generally? You know, if somebody tells you they're sorry and you can see they genuinely mean it, you tend to want to be forgiving. So if you want to teach the child to forgive, you have to give him a chance to forgive once in a while and not always be beyond reproach and the kind of parent. I came from an era where fathers in particular were supposed to be beyond reproach. Fathers didn't make wrong decisions. And so I remember a high school buddy of my oldest child's whose father said, either you cut your hair, this was when, you know, the boys were beginning to let the hair grow and the fathers were ashamed of this, either you cut that hair or you can't have the car. Well, this put the kid in a double bind. We live in suburbia and high school seniors have no way of getting to functions unless they can borrow the family car. There's just no way to go. And, you know, for a while he could get friends to pick him up, but then he got the place he hated to impose on other kids to always come by and get him when he never could come by and get them. Because, you know, kids have to learn to carpool on that score, too. Everybody can't have a family car every Friday night. So the mother talked to me one time, and she said it has just gotten to be a bigger and bigger and bigger thing. And what finally happened was this kid ended up in the psycho ward because father was so unrelenting. And she said to me, it really puts me in the middle because I can understand the kid's feeling. And she said, I've talked to my husband, and he now understands, too, that this is a changing time and that when he's asking Glenn to go to school with short hair, it'd be like him going to the office in the suit he bought in the 1940s with the wide lapels and the pleats and, you know, the kind that are coming back in style now, but were out of style in the 60s. And, you know, he now understands that, she said, but he can't give in. He can't say, hey, Buzz, I've rethought this, and I guess I've changed my mind. You see, the father couldn't do that, and so the hassle had to continue. So, you know, that is good mom.
You know, you say, I'm sorry, and they want to hang on to this. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you're really not sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's your privilege. You know, I mean, that's their privilege. But
so then they can hang on to it.
You don't have to feel like, gee, I've got to go to, you know, great lengths to demonstrate this. If you feel you've done all you can and the person still won't accept it, that's his problem then, isn't it? You know, but if you're genuine, it's usually hard for the person not to get some softening. And maybe he's like the child she's speaking of, that he set this role for himself.
Sometimes I think my daughter said, I'm sorry, it's made me feel better than mm-hmm. It's probably made them feel better.
Sure it has. Those, you know, warm feelings engender more warm feelings, just like icky feelings engender more icky feelings. You know, I mean, when you respond to your child's anger with anger, that makes the child have to respond with more anger, which makes you more angry, and the thing just, you know, it's like a war. You have to, this big arms build up. And gee, you can really, like you say, keep that going in a family. That it, okay, so let's get through this real quick. Okay, but be sure that you are treating symptoms and not behavior. You know, you can take a contact to make your cold feel like it's better, but you're really still sick, right? You know, the germs are still there because we don't know what to do. So if you notice that a child is continually angry at home, try to ask yourself, what can I do to relieve this situation? Are there things that are cutting across this child's developmental place so that he's constantly in a bind? He's always hitting frustrations. There are certain ages, I think, where kids are more frustrated. Sarah and I were just talking about the junior high kids that she taught. Culturally, we somehow impose a horrible problem of going from childhood to adolescence. And you know, adolescent or junior high age kids hit an awful lot of frustrations. Preschool children hit a lot of frustrations because they are intellectually at a place where they want to do, but their muscles don't cooperate. And so they get very frustrated because things won't work the way they want them to.
So, you know, these are times when they really, really need for us to be very patient and very loving and warm about feeling our feelings. Okay, the bell is going to ring. And I wanted to real quick tell you a clever way now of with disciplining. If you can think in terms of modes of thinking, somebody whose research Herb got into rather deeply has discovered that there are at least 120 ways that we think. And yet schools only tap a very few of these. And you could be maybe gifted in 50 mental operations and come out of school thinking you're a failure because schools limit it. The first thing that we, first mental operation that we come across is when we're born is probably something called cognition. And that's just a long word for recognizing things. It comes from the same root as recognize. You recognize that when your mother is there, your pains in your stomach are going to go away real quick, you know, because, or you recognize that when the nipple gets in your mouth, you're going to feel better, and so you suck. And then the next thing that comes in is memory. After a while, you learn that you didn't need to feel the nipple in your mouth, just mother's presence or the presence of any adult made you stop crying because you remembered that when the adult came, then the nipple came and then the pains went away. So that's the second mental operation. And you see school in here, you know, here's the lecture kiddies, remember it, and what's the next thing? Huh? Yeah, the test. And that's called convergent thinking. There is an answer, you remember it, and you put it down on the paper, right? Okay, those three things, we parents tend to limit our things with our children. I told you the rule. Now remember it, and when you get in that situation, do that. Okay, I want to quickly suggest to you that there are two more mental operations that we really ought to be using, and we need a whole session on this. Try, when your child gets into a problem that is frustrating to him, to ask him to do divergent thinking. Convergent means come into one answer, find the answer. Divergent means think of all the answers that you can. And when you run into a discipline problem, instead of, what is the first thing that we generally tend to do to kids? You know, if you're angry, you know, if it makes you mad that the kid did whatever he did, you yell at them. You know, I told, you know, you should have done, and we give the answer. The other thing is that we very lovingly go and give the answer. You know, oh, here, honey, let me help you with that. You should be doing it this way. Neither of which really helps the child, you see, to learn and to grow and to develop her own capacity for decision-making and for thinking other things. So say to the child, you know, let's see how many different ways we can think of that we could have done that.
Sure. I learned that it was called brainstorming for solutions instead of just thinking.
Right.
At home, when my child was five, same way I was talking about, I was having my mother-in-law come to dinner, and his room was just a disaster, and I could just feel the anger seething, and I had to clean his room, and I had to cook dinner, and I had to do this and this and this, and this wasn't going to be enjoyable for me at all. So I went into his room, and I said, what are we going to do about your room? If I clean it up, I'm going to be angry, and I'm not going to enjoy cooking dinner, and why are we even having brownies for dinner, and blah, 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 blah. Well, let's think of some ways to do it. Well, Mom, why don't we just hang a sign on my door and just put, my room looks yucky, please don't open the door.
Okay. Solution number one. Okay, what I want to...
His friend walked in and said, good grief, Nancy, you can't even find your bed in this room.
Ah, I bet that did
it. From him instead of me, and it was just had all kinds of good.
Okay, what I'd like to suggest to you then that you'd want to say, okay, that's one solution. But, you know, generally what we would tend to do is say, well, that's not a good solution. And one of the rules in brainstorming is don't give any value judgments as the ideas come up. Wait until you've got all the ideas you can think of. Then you do convergent thinking and say, okay, let's evaluate. And that is the other strategy I wish you'd do with kids, is ask them to evaluate. Let's look at all these things we've got. Now, we could hang a sign on the door saying the room is too yucky, don't come in. Mother could clean it. You could clean it by yourself. We could clean it together. We could call in the neighbors and ask them. You know, even think of the ridiculous one. Don't laugh. My son pulls that one all the time. He has neighbors come and help him do some of these jobs. So, you know, that is a solution. It may not be a viable one. So this was then you did evaluate. And yeah. Well, what I'd like to suggest is you do this with lots of things with children because it teaches them to think and it gives them a skill to use when you're not around instead of, you know, you thinking or anything. Yeah.
Lady, when I was first very young, said, when you give advice to your children, do it like a bubbling sound. And if you
all the things you can think of. Right. Okay. Very good. I wish we had a whole session just on creative thinking, because it's such a good tool with kids.
You can give that one to me.